two readings that I adopted this morning that I came up with are from the book of Philippians. Most of us probably know the book of Philippians because it exhorts us to rejoice. Paul seems to be able to find joy even though he's in prison. He sees some reason that for why it's happening, that the gospel is still being able to advance in the midst of his troubles and trials. He tells them not only to rejoice later in the book, but he says also to find the peace that passes understanding. He also tells them to think about what is good and noble and right in the book of Philippians. So he has a lot of really good and interesting things to say. I think it's significant also that if you read through the book, you pick out a few spots in there where Paul exhibits a very joyful attitude toward them. He asked them in verse 2 of chapter 2 to complete the joy that he already feels by living a certain way. In chapter 2 and verse 19, he's hoping to get news about them so that he can be cheered by that news. And he calls them in chapter 4 and verse 1 his joy and his crown. So not only is the Apostle Paul exhorting them to rejoice, he seems to be able to find in them a great source of emotional power, a great sense of joy in just what they are and who they are and what they've done. That kind of joy, I think, is infectious, isn't it? It grows, I think, certainly out of this book, out of a group cemented together by working together for the sake of the gospel, and I think developing a certain sense of camaraderie in doing that. As I thought about this lesson, I kind of reflected on the book of Philippians and some things that maybe I hadn't quite thought about before. One of the things that's noticeable about the book of Philippians, Paul's not trying to correct any what seem to be any serious doctrinal errors. Now, I know in chapter 3 he warns them to be on the lookout for those who are the, the Judaizers, you know, those who feel like it's important to have your Jewish heritage, and that's really important. Paul says that's rubbish. He says just be on the lookout for them. But there doesn't seem to be any real serious doctrinal errors that he's trying to correct. And as I begin to think about it, I kind of wonder if the book of Philippians isn't one of those books in which Paul is simply trying to create a community outlook and one that's conducive to growth, conducive to working together, and conducive to the acceptance of those perhaps who might take a look at them and might want to join them. Outsiders, non-Christians. As I thought about it, I happened to be, and I wasn't thinking about it while I was doing this, but I was watching one of the football games last night, Michigan State and Nebraska, and Michigan State almost lost the game. They were ahead 27-3 and ended up just winning by 27-22. But one of the interesting things that they kept saying about this new coach was that when he came several years ago to coach Michigan State, he had to bring with him a whole new culture. He had to change the culture of the football program. And by that, I know what they mean by that. When you come into a program that may not be a winning program, you have to change the way they think so that they can become a winning program. And he's managed to do that. He's managed to bring a whole way of thinking that has gotten them to become a much better program than they were until before he got there. That's what they mean when they talk about you got to change the whole culture of the thing. And I kind of wonder if the book of Philippians isn't a matter of when we look at it, we look at the culture Paul wants to continue to cultivate among the Philippians. And if it isn't the culture that we have to continue to propagate and to develop among ourselves, okay? Again, if you think about Philippians, he's not trying to correct some doctrinal problem. Don't seem to be any issues that's kind of getting them off course like a number of the other books. So I think there are some things in the book of Philippians that help us see the kind of things necessary to develop the right culture of Christianity, let's call it, okay? The right culture of winning. Think about joy. Joy is infectious, isn't it? Wouldn't you rather be around somebody that's positive rather than somebody just complaining all the time? You know, it's infectious, isn't it? Wouldn't you rather be around a group that really seeks to love one another rather than one who seeks to simply always point out the mistakes of others? Well, that's kind of part of what he's doing here. He's trying to say that we need to have a culture of rejoicing, and I think a number of other things. So let's kind of point out, I'm going to spend a couple of weeks on this, but for today, I want to look at three things that I think, along with joy, are things that are characteristics of the culture of a good church. Number one, a willingness to serve. Okay, we probably all know that. All right, but I want you to see how Paul couches that discussion here in chapter 1. In chapter 1, verse 21, Paul says, to live is Christ, to die is gain. And the discussion here that Paul has here is an interesting one for himself personally. Because he realizes that, you know what, Paul's kind of caught in his own little dilemma here. Because he knows if he dies and goes to be with Christ. Now remember, he's in prison, so he may not know exactly what's going to happen to him. But he says, you know what, if I die now, I will be a happy man. I will gain my eternal life that I'm striving toward. But then he also realizes, you know, if he continues on in this life, what's he got? More work. He's got to endure more work and service, but it's on behalf of the church. Verses 22 through 26 really explain this in quite a bit of detail. Paul says, if I am to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me. Yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. I'm hard pressed between the two. There's his dilemma. Should I go? Would I be better off being with Christ? Yeah, that'd be better for me. My desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better. But to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. Convinced of this, I know that I will remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy in the faith, so that in me you may have ample cause to glory in Christ Jesus because of my coming to you again. Now we've already seen that Paul's invested a lot of joy in this church. He calls them his joy and his crown. He's telling them to rejoice. He's telling them, look, all that's been happening to me has been working out for good, so rejoice in that. And yet, he still faces this little bit of a dilemma. How does he resolve it? He resolves it by simply saying, you know what? If God wants me to stay and serve more, I'm going to do that. And I'm going to be content with that service. And so although it may not be his first choice is to die and be with Christ and enter into that eternal life that we're all striving to get, but he knows it's God's will for him to continue. He sees the need, verse 24, and resolves to do it. It is intended to result in progress and more joy for them. So you see, Paul resolves his dilemma by, in a way, kind of being certain way of self-sacrificing himself, okay? He sees service as what God has called him to do. And so the dilemma of choosing what's better and getting what's not quite as good, he still chooses that because it's God's will. He serves. He has a willingness to serve, and that's how he resolves the dilemma that he has. It is a choice that he has to make. And if you think about it this way, he's kind of making a choice that is characteristic of delayed gratification. I read a number of years ago that a number of psychologists suggest, I think rightly so, that delayed gratification is one of the real hallmarks of maturity. That you don't necessarily expect to get everything right away. Expect to get all your rewards right away. Expect to be gratified right away. You put it off because you know there are more important things to do, and hopefully it comes later on, but you delay it because you know it's necessary and you are a responsible person. Now, not all of us will have exactly the same choice that Paul has. Not all of us will have to endure, well, you know, if I die, I'd be better off, but yeah, I really kind of need to stay. Yeah, maybe in a way we kind of have to do that. But we all have to have the same willingness to serve that Paul has. And that's the point here. I think that's the key to what Paul is doing here. He's telling them to choose to serve with the same willingness that he has chosen to serve. and have the same contentment, knowing that at some point you're still going to get the reward that you have been promised, or that you will get gratified with seeing the results and fruits of your labor at some point, but you still have to make that choice. And it's a choice that Paul can make joyfully, and I think it's a choosing that can reflect also a joyful experience for us and an encouragement to others. So the first thing that I think is characteristic of a culture of Christianity and a good church is that willingness to serve. The second thing that I think is a characteristic of it is what Paul says in verse 27, walk worthy of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Only let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or am absent, I may hear of you that you are standing firm in one spirit, with one mind, striving side by side for the face of the gospel. And that's kind of an interesting one as well, isn't it? Now, we all know, I think, that we're supposed to live worthy of the gospel of Jesus Christ. But I think what the apostle does here with it is kind of significant as well. Because I think what he's trying to get his church to see here is continue to have courage in the face of adversity. I think courage is one of those characteristics that is just as infectious as joy. I'm sorry about the sports references. I'm just into sports. You know, I love the references you can make. When Nebraska last night, playing Michigan State, same game I was talking about earlier, when they were down 27-3, it was in the fourth quarter. They didn't give up. And their quarterback played a really, really great game. Unfortunately, one little mistake at the end cost them the game. They could have come back and beaten Michigan State. But he demonstrated real leadership by having courage, by keep playing the game, by keep doing what he knew he needed to do. Nothing was working up to that point. He kept hammering away at trying to do the right thing. And sure enough, they started scoring. Their offense sort of picked up some steam. And they ended up scoring 19 points in the fourth quarter. Michigan State almost lost the game because of that. But see, and that kind of courage of leadership is infectious. You see, when somebody does it, everybody goes, okay, maybe we can do this. And maybe when we have a little bit of success. Look at what Paul says here in verse 28. He says, and not frightened, I want you to not be frightened by anything by your opponents. Isn't that interesting? Paul's in prison. He knows that good things are happening as a result of imprisonment. He says, guys, don't let this get you down. Do not be frightened by your opponents. You know, in sports, you have to learn, don't be frightened by your opponents. You have to just kind of keep doing what you know you need to do. Adversaries always seek to exploit weaknesses and fear. They can almost sense your fear. But you see, I believe when an enemy determines that you will not back down, a lot of times that enemy goes, oh, well, I don't kind of know what to do with this. Your courage can actually strike fear into their hearts. Think about the schoolyard bully. Okay? He walks around, takes advantage of everybody, you know, he does this, he does that. Finally, when somebody decides to stand up to him, suddenly he's not a threat anymore. Somebody stands up to him. Now, you know, I'm not saying that we should be like the people who are standing up to the schoolyard bully in the same sense. But in one sense, I am. You have to have courage in the face of adversity. You have to not let your opponents deter you from doing what you need to do. Paul says in verse 30, I want to see that you are engaged in the same conflict you saw that I had and now hear that I still have. Stay engaged in the conflict. I'm not asking you to, I don't think Paul or anybody was asking us to go out and face the lions, although who knows if we might have to face that. I hope none of us ever have to. But stay engaged in the conflict. Do not be afraid by your enemies. Have courage. Stand up. And when somebody perhaps threatens your faith, don't be afraid to say, well, yeah, that's what I believe. Yeah, that's really kind of all you have to do. You stand firm for what you believe. And you can do that with gentleness and respect that I think is also very consistent with what a culture of joy would be. But the fact is, it does take courage to do that. So Paul is saying to them, you know, have courage in the face of adversity. Now, he tells them something else here that we actually didn't read, but I think all of us are aware. Well, we did read it, actually. Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 and 4, I think is another way of exhibiting what is a manner worthy of the life that to which we have been called. And that simply is demonstrating humility toward one another. In verses 3 through 4, Paul says a number of things that are such a foundation for our personal relationships. He says, have no rivalry or conceit. Do nothing out of rivalry or conceit. You may want to go back sometime later today and also take a look at, read and reflect on the book of James, and this time James chapter 3 verses 14 through 16, in which James is talking about the wisdom that comes from above versus the wisdom that comes from the earth, from earthly things, from the flesh. He says, but if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast and be false to the truth. This is not the wisdom that comes from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. James, in his classic, you know, plain talk, is how he describes it. But he says, for where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder and every vile practice. Paul is essentially saying the same thing. Don't do anything out of rivalry or selfish ambition. Humility, he will tell them. I think he says essentially, it supersedes pride and self-righteousness. Most people will turn and walk out of such an environment where there is a lot of pride and a lot of self-righteousness, unless they are paid to be there, you know, and they have to endure it. But the fact is, Paul says, look, consider others better than yourselves. He tells them, look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. Think about what an environment that would create for you. Now, I realize this, I kind of appeal to people sometimes when I look at this in a sort of self-interested way. If I walk into a group and I'm the only one thinking about me, how many people in the group are there that are thinking about me? One. All right, if I walk into a group and at least some of the other members are doing what Paul says here, look to the interest of others, how many more people are there thinking about me? Well, of course, if everybody's doing it, then everybody's not only thinking about themselves, they're thinking about me. Or maybe at least get a few others who are concerned about me. So there's something, in a way, kind of self-serving about having no self-interest. It's kind of a paradox, perhaps, but it works, doesn't it? You end up with a lot of other people thinking about you when you and them are all thinking about the interest of others as well as yourselves. Service and humility are founded upon the example that Christ gave us, and that's what Paul will say in verses 5 through 11 of chapter 2. But two things represent the manner of life worthy of the gospel: courage and humility. Let's institute those things. The third thing that Paul says here, and the final thing that I want to talk about, is really he says to work out your own salvation. Chapter 2, verses 12 and 13. Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only as in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. Work out your own salvation. Be about the business of your own salvation. First of all, God's the one that is working within you. So you have a power available to you while you're working out your salvation. It's not all you, but it's God working in you. You see, God's already done something for you. Just kind of keep on working it out amongst yourselves and for yourselves individually and corporately. Work out your own salvation. Keep salvation as the goal of what you do, of everything that you do. And I think consistent with that is a very interesting passage here that he says, do all things without grumbling. And that kind of brings us back to his whole discussion on joy, doesn't it? In verse 14, he says, do all things without grumbling or questioning. Remember Israel in the desert? There was a whole generation of people who lost their salvation because they were grumblers and fault finders. And I've always just found that absolutely amazing, because it was that very generation that had seen everything God had done in the Egypt. They had witnessed all the plagues. They had seen the power of God. They had rejoiced when they came out. They had seen, they had turned back when Pharaoh's army was destroyed in the water. They turned back and just saw the bodies floating in the water. And it was that very same group of people who just grumbled and found fault, didn't like what was going on, complained the whole time. God said, after a point, I've just had enough with these people. They're turning back. I'm going to raise up a whole new generation. I don't know if Paul is dealing with that kind of a group here. I don't think they're that bad off. But I'm guessing that, he wants to continue to promote the kind of culture and the kind of environment that promotes growth, that promotes spiritual well-being, that promotes good relationships. Grumbling is not one of those things that will do it. And so he tells them, do all things without grumbling. Not many things will ruin the spirit of a congregation more than grumbling and complaining about everybody else. So be very careful about that. He tells them in verse 16, hold fast to the word of life. Is he not kind of returning there to this issue of courage in the face of adversity? Doesn't courage in the face of adversity strengthen you to hold fast to the word of life? Maybe it's the holding fast that gives you courage. I'm not sure which one comes first, but the fact is, holding fast, standing firm, is very much a part of having courage in the face of adversity. And joy, I believe, results when we remain faithful. We can be joyful and not ashamed when we've stood up and said, well, I'm just going to stand firm in what I believe. I'm not going to allow things to get me off track. And ours is a message of life. Hold fast to the word of life. Why not hold on to that? Why not hold on to that which truly gives us life and which promises us an eternity of life? Who wouldn't want to hold on to that? I know it's tough. I know there are times of adversity in all of our lives. But it really comes down to, do we want to hold on to that which gives us life? And of course, verse 18, he says, likewise, you also should be glad and rejoice with me. I think that's kind of interesting because, the humility and the experience and the camaraderie that they share, it sort of builds a mutual joy. Okay? And I think if nothing else, Paul wants to develop a community that is joyful, that finds joy in those things. I think these are among the things that I've mentioned here that create an environment for our own personal spiritual growth, for the growth of a community, for the health of a community. They create, I believe, an attractive community conducive not only to our own growth, but to conducive to the acceptance of others, of outsiders, of people who may be searching for something positive in their lives. So I would encourage you to do the things we've mentioned. Number one, be willing to serve. Maybe as a corollary to that, find joy even in menial tasks. Number two, stand firm and have courage in the face of adversity. You will find that you will be able to lead others by your courage. A lot of times when we stand up to people, they may not say anything about it at first, but I think they'll at least have some admiration that, I don't agree and like what the person says, but, they had courage. They had courage in their convictions. Number three, work out your salvation. Instead of grumbling, look for positive ways of looking at life and dealing with the problems you come up with. Okay? I know that can be a real tricky thing to do, but you have to look for, you have to be solution oriented. And if anything, the people in Israel were not. They were faithless. Find joy in serving as Christ served. Hold out the gospel to others as we encourage and hold it out to ourselves here today. Eric?